Welcome back to Alternative Realities. I'm David Kelly, Chief Global Strategist here at JP Morgan Asset Management. On previous episodes, we've discussed what's called the democratization of alternatives. Put simply, alternatives have become more accessible to individuals as the investment vehicles have evolved to address pain points like high minimums and long lock periods. Today, I'm excited to be joined by my former colleague, Anastasia Amoroso, now the Chief Investment Strategist at iCapital, whose platform is designed to help clients navigate the world of alternative investments. We'll hear from Anastasia about what iCapital does to help individuals feel confident in investing in alternatives, as well as getting her perspective on the trends we're seeing in the market. So Anastasia, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thanks, David. It's great to be joining you today.
So to start off with, can you tell me a little bit about iCapital and how it fits into the alternative investment ecosystem?
Yes, absolutely. So iCapital plays a key role in the alternative investments ecosystem and specifically helping democratize the access to alternative investments for private clients. So what does that mean is that we connect a network of alternative investment managers with some of the wirehouses and private bank clients, as well as independent financial advisors. And we believe to truly enable this process of democratization of alternatives, you really have to focus on key things. You have to focus on technology, on access, and of course, also education. And so when we talk about access, historically, alternatives has been an asset class that has been reserved for institutional clients. The reason for that is because in order to access it, you had to make an allocation that was in the millions of dollars. And clearly, that's not always accessible to a typical private client. So by focusing on different type of investment vehicles, different types of registrations, and also structuring different vehicles, we are able to bring down those allocation minimums so that they do become accessible to private clients. The second thing, David, I would say technology plays such a key role in this process, and we focus on iCapital quite a lot because it's not as easy as buying a stock or a bond or a mutual fund, but there is a subscription process that is involved. There's a whole life cycle of an alternative investment that is involved. And so providing technology that makes it easy, streamlined, and efficient is what we focus on. And then lastly, David, is about education. You know, again, it's not as simple and intuitive as buying a stock or a bond, but there's a lot that has to go into understanding what is it that you're buying when it comes to private equity, private credit, and more. So an education pillar is a really important one for us.
So that's really interesting. So you're expanding the base of people who are able to access alternatives. Can you tell me a little bit about, okay, so what is your typical client then, and how are they allocated right now, roughly?
Yes. So as I mentioned, we work with three types of clients across the alternatives ecosystem. The first, of course, is an alternatives asset manager or a general partner, as we call it, and we provide the technology for those clients. The second are the private bank clients as well as large wirehouse clients. And again, we provide the technology for those. But the third component of our client base is the independent financial advisor. And so RIAs, independent broker dealers, and really working with those clients to help them increase those allocation to alternatives. So David, to your question about how are those clients allocating to alts today? Well, first of all, the allocations tend to be rather small relative to what we see in the institutional space. And so, for example, a typical RIA client allocates somewhere between 5% and 6% to alternatives. Now, I will say that ranges depending on the size of the RIA, depending on the wealth profile of the client. And so for a high net worth client, that allocation may be closer to 13%. For sort of a mass affluent client, that allocation may really be only 3%. But the thing that I would also say, David, that is so key and interesting is that the allocations are small, and also not every single advisor is actually allocating to alternatives today. In fact, only 36% of advisors allocate to alternatives. So that means the rest of them don't, but we certainly do see an increased interest in education, which I think will eventually lead to those much greater allocations.
And so do you then think that those allocations will grow and then over the next few years? And then also, I guess, within asset classes in alternative asset allocations, roughly speaking, what are the big areas that people tend to go for when they're adding alternative assets to portfolios?
Yes. I think there's a tremendous growth potential in terms of the allocations where we see them today going into the future. You know, I say this because a lot of advisors are telling us, are telling, you know, various survey providers that they are expecting to increase their allocations to alternatives. And when we ask the question, well, what is the optimal allocation that you see? They see somewhere between 12 and 13% allocations to alts. And to me, for now, that seems like a very nice goal to work towards because most likely private wealth individuals are not going to allocate 30 or 40 or 50% that a lot of institutional investors do because there are liquidity considerations. But getting from 5 to 12%, that seems like definitely the next step forward. And what I'll also say, David, is that in terms of the amount of wealth that can potentially be allocated to alternatives, it's really significant. So if we tally up all the wealth of sovereign wealth funds and endowments and foundations and other institutional investors, that turns out to be $140 trillion, give or take. But if we look at the wealth that is held and controlled by private wealth clients, that is also approximately $135 trillion as well. So for the industry as a whole, this is a significant opportunity to go from 5% to 10%, maybe eventually to 15%. And then, David, to your point, in terms of where do we see the allocations today, a few years ago, the kind of the first foray into alternatives really started with real estate. And with the advent of some of the semi-liquid real estate funds that allowed participation, allowed income, but also had some redemption criteria, we saw clients allocate to those. But I would say over the last year and a half, there's been a lot of interest in private credit. And when we look at the flows on the iCapital platform, we see that about 43% gets allocated to private credit, at least it did in the first quarter of this year. And that's quite a step higher from last year where we saw about 35% of the flows go to private credit. So I think there's a significant focus on income. And the second category behind that is still private equity though.
And what would you say are the biggest hurdles for to get people comfortable about investing in alternatives? I mean, both, I guess, the advisors and also the individual clients. What are the biggest hurdles and how's the industry evolving to try to address those?
Yes, I think one of the biggest hurdles is, of course, illiquidity and this very different notion that you can trade in and out of alternatives as you can with a stock or a bond. And, you know, this idea that, you know, you have to commit capital for 10 years. So that's one of the biggest obstacles. But I think the industry is making really great strides in really tailoring the solutions that are a better fit for a private client than they might have been for an institution. And so what I mean by that is you do have now a proliferation of the semi-liquid tender-offer funds, for example, in private credit. And so rather than committing all of your capital for, let's say, you know, 7 or 10 years, you do make an allocation, but there is also at least a partial quarterly redemption feature. And I think that goes a long way in helping clients understand that they shouldn't trade in and out of this, but at the same time, if there is a liquidity need, there's a valve for it. So I would say that's the first way that the industry is adapting. The second one is that we're taking a step further even, and you look at some of these semi-liquid private equity products, and rather than calling down the capital over a period of, let's say, 3 to 5 years, and then having to wait 10 years before the fund is ultimately redeemed, some of the new structures allow clients to allocate capital today and to be fully invested today in private equity, again, with some partial liquidity valve. And so that experience feels a lot more similar than what they may have seen in the public markets, and therefore I think reduces some of those barriers to entry. And then maybe the last thing I'll say about that is, you know, there's private equity funds and then there's secondary private equity funds where you can buy a secondary stake from different managers, from different vintages. And by doing that, you minimize, well, first of all, you get yourself a lot of diversification, but second of all, you minimize the J-curve effect. And so for clients who maybe are not experienced with private equity, this is yet another way to overcome that illiquidity obstacle.
So sticking with private equity, it doesn't always get the best of press. I mean, there is You know, frequently they're accused of just adding financial engineering to a business rather than anything else. But how would you talk to investors about investing in private equity today?
Yes. I mean, there's definitely a lot of managers that may have used financial engineering, especially, you know, over the course of 10 or 14 years that we had zero interest rates. And David, when you look at the dispersion of returns in private equity, it is very, very wide. For example, a typical buyout fund, an average buyout fund, I should say, generated a return of about 14% IRR over the last 20 some years. But if you look at the dispersion of those returns, it is really, really wide. So maybe the bottom decile barely generated a return, while the top one maybe did double and generate about 30%. So I think over time, as we get out, well, clearly we have been out of the zero interest rate environment. As we get to a more normalized environment of, let's say, 3.5% interest rates, managers who solely relied on cheap leverage are just not going to be able to deliver the results. And so that's one key thing to keep in mind. But broadly, how do private equity managers generate returns? Yes, adding some debt and paying that debt down is one of those options, but it's really two other key opportunities for return, which is multiple expansion. And the key one is operational improvement. Now, I think going forward, cheap leverage, let's say it's no longer an option, multiple expansion, maybe if you have a skilled manager that's able to buy a company cheap and sell it at a more expensive multiple. But the key point is operational improvement. Can the manager identify a company and a strategy to improve operations, to infuse efficiencies, you know, perhaps infuse automation and artificial intelligence that can lead to greater revenue and earnings growth for that company? So that's what we find truly distinguishes some of the best private equity managers is what sort of operational improvement can they make? And when you look at the attribution of returns, David, for private equity managers versus public equities, it's really the outsized revenue growth and the outsized earnings growth that leads to the bulk of the returns that private equity is able to generate. So while I understand the headlines, I think there's a lot more behind it. And it's really seeking managers that are skilled at working with companies and executing a strategic plan. That's what tends to lead to outperformance of private equity.
It's really all about the alpha and the expertise rather than the leverage going forward.
It truly is. I mean, at some point it was about the leverage and everybody can do it, but this is a very different environment where the focus is on the skill set.
The other thing that comes up with regard to private equity is that there's a lack of exit activity right now and also a pretty sluggish market in terms of IPOs. So what is your perspective on that?
Yes, so the exit activity has understandably been slow. You know, first of all, you know, nobody wants to IPO in an environment where you're not sure what the valuations are going to do, or you're not sure what the economy is going to do, and you're not sure what the central banks are going to do. And so that's what's really deterred some of that activity. But if you look at the environment today, and if you sort of, you know, put this together in an IPO barometer, we actually see quite a bit of an improvement. Clearly, corporate confidence is up significantly. The economy is doing okay, quite well, actually. And on top of that, we've just started the interest rate cutting cycle, which should support valuations. So that should give some of the managers a lot more confidence, I think, to seek a public exit for their companies. We have seen some of that. We have seen a pickup in IPO. But importantly, David, what I would say, the IPO tends to be an important valve for some of the growth equity portfolio companies or venture. But for a typical buyout private equity, it's really about corporate acquisitions. You know, can a big tech company potentially acquire a smaller portfolio company? And it also tends to be about sponsor to sponsor activity as well, as one company maybe wants to seek a bolt-on acquisition and buy it from another manager. So when I look at that type of activity, we have seen a significant pickup in corporate M&A. And also when I look at the deal activity across the private market space, we are on track to surpass the deal activity that we saw in 2023. So I think the exit valve is opening up quite nicely. And, you know, David, when you buy a company, you want to keep it, you want to operational improve it. And historically, you have done that for about 5 years. But after 5 years, you have an exit. Well, today, given this lack of exit environment, that time frame has expanded to about 6.2 years. So I think there is a fair bit of pent-up demand from both GPs and also LPs, the limited partners, to see those exits. And now that the macroeconomic environment is has improved and the rate environment has improved, I think that's what will lead to this pickup in exit activity. So it is to come, and it should benefit some of the private equity performance going forward.
No, no, I'd also re-emphasize, you know, one of the reasons why we think about private equity is there are a lot of companies that may never come public and never want to go public, but there's a lot of, you know, economic dynamism in those companies, particularly with operational improvements.
That's right.
So you mentioned earlier about, you know, just the investor interest in private credit. Of course, we're seeing a lot of interest there also. But we have seen some signs of defaults creeping up. And then I also have some questions about, you know, how reliable defaults are given the flexibility within private credit. What's your perspective on that?
Right. So defaults have certainly picked up in private credit. If you look at the private credit default rate, let's say in 2021, it was about 0.24%. If you look at it today, it's closer to 1.5% and 2%. So that's certainly been a significant pickup. But what's interesting is that we seem to have peaked in terms of defaults, and we are starting to go the other way around. You know, why is that? Well, because rates are actually falling. And if you looked at some of the forward curves, forward SOFR curves, for example, they've been falling for quite some time. So what does that mean? That in terms of interest coverage ratio for a lot of these private credit companies, they have already started to improve. So 6 months ago, the interest coverage ratio was, let's say, 1.6 times. But if the market expectations are correct and the Fed funds rate ends up being around 3.6% by middle of 2025, those coverage ratios will start to improve towards 2 times again. And so for that reason, I actually have a constructive view on defaults, and I think some of the peak pain is now behind us. I will also make two other points on that, David, because not all defaults are created equal. And actually, if you have a private credit borrower that has a private equity sponsor, the default rates for those PE-backed company tended to be lower. Because to your point, a private equity manager may step in and offer additional flexibility where that's just not an option if you don't have that sponsor. And the last thing I'll say, you know, yes, it's natural to worry about defaults, you know, whether it's private credit, whether it's in high yield, whether it's in leveraged loans, but this is where it helps to take a look at the history of private credit. And if I look at the last 17 years, David, there was one of those years that generated a negative return. And that was a negative return of minus 7% about in 2008. So even in the greatest financial crisis, you know, the default rate was relatively subdued and the losses were recouped the following year. You know, if I also look at, you know, how private credit tends to perform over time, and if I look at a 3-year rolling you know, performance basis, there's not a single 3-year time period where private credit generated negative returns. The worst one was plus 5%. So yes, we can worry about defaults. I do think some of the peak pain is behind us. But importantly, because of the high coupon, because of the high income, because of the expertise, private credit has managed defaults quite well over time.
So this podcast seems to be a lot about worries. Let me give you another worry. A lot of people seem to be worried.
We got to dispel the worries.
Well, exactly. I mean, you have to balance the worries with the returns, which have been very good across alternative assets in general. But one question we get a lot is about real estate, and particularly about commercial real estate. How concerned are you about defaults in commercial real estate?
Yes, I think it's another concern that has been well telegraphed. And much like the defaults in private credit, I think some of those risks may actually be behind us. I will put an asterisk, and I'll come back to this next to the office commercial real estate. But broadly speaking, what happened in commercial real estate is a huge price correction. CRE has done really well in 2022, but 2023 was a down 12% year. Early 2024 was still negative the first couple of quarters. But what we started to see in the last quarter or so is a stabilization and a bottoming process, and I would even say an inflection in commercial real estate prices. So from the peak of CRE that we saw in the second quarter of 2022, at some point, commercial real estate was down about 15-16%. Today, it's down about 10%. And there's of course a big dispersion if you look at industrial real estate versus office. Office may still be down 20, in some cases 30%, but industrial real estate, for example, has started to move back higher. So I think this price stability, this newfound price stability, should certainly alleviate some of the default concerns. And also the fact that interest rates are finally going down is a huge help for commercial real estate, because about 50% of CRE loans are floating rate, which means the relief has already started. So price stability, rate relief, and then when I look at the net operating income for commercial real estate, it's still growing. It's still growing at 3 or 4%. So actually, maybe in some cases, even surpassing inflation. So you put all that together, and I say that some of the default risks are well telegraphed and probably overblown in this case in commercial real estate. Now, I promise I will come back to the asterisk, which was the office space. It's different. You know, when you look at multifamily vacancies, for example, they're extremely low. When you look at industrial vacancies, they're extremely low. When you look at office vacancies, they're very high, 17% and rising. So I do think it's going to take time to work through some of the restructuring and the pain in the office space. But given that's about 16% of the aggregate, I think this is a risk that can be managed.
All right. Well, listen, thank you so much for taking us on this tour around the alternative universe and the way that individual investors can really access it. And I think this is really interesting, Anastasia. So I hope you'll come back and join us again on Alternative Reality soon. But again, thank you very much for joining us today.
Anytime, David. Thanks so much.
This content is intended for information only, based on assumptions and current market conditions, and are subject to change. No warranty of accuracy is given. This content does not contain sufficient information to support investment decisions. It is not to be construed as research, legal, regulatory, tax, accounting, or investment advice. Investments involve risks. Investors should seek professional advice or make an independent evaluation before investing. The value of investments and the income from them may fluctuate, including loss of capital. Past performance and yield are not indicative of current or future results. Forecasts and estimates may or may not come to pass. J.P. Morgan Asset Management is the asset management business of J.P. Morgan Chase & Company and its affiliates worldwide.
This material is for information purposes only. The views, opinions, and statements of financial market trends that are based on current market conditions are those of the speaker and may differ from those expressed by J.P. Morgan Asset Management or by other areas of J.P. Morgan Chase & Company. Any companies referenced are shown for illustrative purposes only and are not intended as a recommendation. We believe the information provided here is reliable, but should not be assumed to be accurate or complete. The views and strategies described may not be suitable for all investors.